Good morning, and thank you for joining us for today's panel discussion on race, liberty, and the future of meritocracy in America. I'm Mary Thoreau, Chairman and CEO of Independent Institute, the academic research institute exploring critical issues of current concern and offering innovative, non-politicized solutions. Today's conversation brings together contributors to our latest book, Race and Liberty in America. Jonathan Bean is both editor of and a contributor to the book. He is a research fellow at Independent Institute and professor of history at Southern Illinois University. Before DOGE, Professor Bean testified before the U.S. Senate on corruption in government contracting. His popular articles, interviews, and investigative work have appeared in print or on air with a wide range of media outlets, and he is also the author of several books, including Opposing Viewpoints in U.S. History. David Bernstein holds a university professorship chair at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. A graduate of Yale Law School, he is the author of 5 books and co-author of 2 others, including Only One Place of Redress, African Americans, Labor Regulations, and the Courts, From Reconstruction to the New Deal. And most recently, Classified, The Untold Story of Racist Classification in America. Wilfred Riley is an associate professor of political science at Kentucky State University and is characterized in Jonathan Bean's introduction as, quote, one of our era's great contrarian debunkers. He received his PhD in political science from Southern Illinois University and JD from the University of Illinois College of Law. Dr. Riley's books include Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About, and The $50 Million Question. Kenny Zhu is president of Color Us United, an organization advocating for a race-blind, meritocratic America that empowers people, especially through educational institutions that uphold high standards. He has challenged race-based admissions across the U.S., and has most recently taken on medical school admissions. He's the author of An Inconvenient Minority, the Harvard Admissions Case and the Attack on Asian American Excellence. I'll now turn it over to our panelists for their discussion, which will take about 45 minutes, following which we'll open it up to questions from the audience. Dr. Bean?
Thank you, Mary. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm delighted that we have several esteemed contributors as well. I want to just start by framing what the book is about. This is the second edition of Race and Liberty in America. When it came out in 2009, Race and Liberty in America was the first collection of writings documenting the role of the classical liberal tradition in civil rights. Classical liberals valued individual freedom, not group rights, colorblindness, equal protection under the law, and they saw capitalism as a liberating force for minorities. For many generations, this tradition dominated various civil rights movements. Classical liberals fought slavery, lynching, segregation, Chinese exclusion, Japanese internment, and racial distinctions in the law, all topics covered in Race and Liberty in America. As immigration advocates, they defended the natural right of migration to America. This is a tradition that is neither left nor right. 2009 marked the high point of optimism about race relations. Americans had elected the first Black president, or biracial president, if you prefer. And polls showed Americans of all races felt the goals of the civil rights movement had been achieved. And then, beginning in the 2010s, and especially after the killing of George Floyd, the rise of Black Lives Matter, popularity of books like Ibam Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist, the New York Times 1619 Project, and demands for reparations, we've gone from optimism to fatalism. But boy, how things have changed in the last year or so. The U.S. Supreme Court decision striking down affirmative action and race preferences in 2023, the election of Donald Trump, and a general vibe shift against DEI. Americans are looking for new approaches, and this updated edition provides a proven strategy. It extends the story of classical liberal perspectives to the present with new contributions by Thomas Sowell, Holman Hughes, Thomas Chatterton Williams, Wilfred Riley, Kenny Hsu, David Bernstein, Ilya Sohman, the U.S. Supreme Court, and myself. Together, we make the case that classical liberal values are the best path forward, which brings me to this event today. I'm delighted to have with me three outstanding contributors. Will Riley is one of the most colorful writers since H.L. Mencken destroyed the absurdities of his era. Will's latest book, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, will de-bamboozle new generation. Kenny Hsu's Inconvenient Minority inspired me with his highlighting of the hard-earned success of Asian Americans and the injustices done to them by so-called progressive elites. There's a lesson there for all Americans. Finally, David Bernstein, I've long admired your work on history and law. Your Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America does a great job of laying out the idiocy of state-sponsored racial classification. One hopes that someday we can roll back the checkboxes. Okay, without further ado, I have some questions that some of them are open-ended, some of them are directed at one of you in particular, but anybody can jump in and feel free to have a conversation about the themes of the book. My first question is open-ended. What inspired you to contribute to this specific collection of writings, Race and Liberty in America?
I guess I'll start. Thank you so much for having me here, Jonathan. And Wilfred and David, you know, your contributions are respected. I wanted to contribute to Race and Liberty because the feeling of being a racial minority is often indulged in American society. The academy and media and government policies combine together to make you, if you're a racial minority, you feel like you need to be in a separate category. And Race and Liberty is an attempt to counter that. The feeling of being in a separate category can provide power for some people, but it is always at the expense of other people. For example, Black power. Yes, you can feel like you are a Black person and therefore you're discriminated, oppressed in this country. But what does that engender in you? Well, it engenders in you in-group favoritism, prejudice towards your own class or your own race, hostility towards the other, and all of these things that form the negative intellectual environment today regarding race that has damaged their social consciousness. So when I wrote my book, An Inconvenient Minority, I sought that to counter that through in an innovative way, which is to say, well, okay, if we extend that racial sentiment to its logical extent, then do Asian Americans deserve a racial hostility towards the progressive elites that discriminate against them in the college admissions process? And how much? The findings of the Harvard case were damning. The Asian Americans were basically forced into a racial category that was lower than even white people in college admissions. And as long as that is allowed to spread, Asian Americans should be allowed to counter that. But the ultimate goal, I think, that we're all trying to pursue in Race and Liberty here is racial harmony through principles that transcend race. And I think that that's what we have to recover in America. Because if we go down the road of racial retributivism, we're eventually going to get into a very hostile place. And I don't want our country to be that. I don't want our kids to be that.
Will, you were going to jump in.
Yeah, so I agreed to contribute for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, John, I went to Southern Illinois. As I recall, you are you reviewed my doctoral dissertation, so it would have been very rude for me to say no. I mean, that's part of it. But also, I think that the Race and Liberty series is well-known, well-reviewed, and I think it's important that there be a counter to what for about a decade was the dominant view, frankly, in the academy of race relations and how to handle them in the United States. And I think it's fair to say that was sort of the Ibram Kendi, Robin DiAngelo, Richard Delgado perspective, which actually, although I might personally think it's idiotic, is extremely coherent. The idea is that all disparities between groups reflect essentially discrimination. I mean, on page 12 of How to Be an Anti-Racist, Kendi essentially rejects all of culturalism. He says, which is, I think, the philosophy Kenny and I would share, he says that the two options are either there's some kind of bias in systems, however subtle and diffuse, or there's something wrong with folks. Their genetic inferiority is what he's referencing there. And so what you need to do is adopt a set of policies that close all performance gaps between people. That's what DEI is intended to be. So this is the framework that these people are working from. And I mean, there have been articles that run in the Times and the Journal with titles like, "We Need an Anti-Racist Constitutional Amendment." I think that was the Atlantic, in fact. So there needs to be a counter frame, which is not just like, oh, that's a bunch of bull from, you know, guys on golf courses or in faculty lounges. You put together books like this and coherently respond. And I think the coherent response is kind of in two parts. Well, one, no. There are dozens of cultural, historical, stochastic, et cetera, factors that cause different groups to perform differently. Asians, as I'm sure Kenny would be, has been known to point out, study, I believe it's twice as much as white Americans, three times as much as Black Americans, things like this contribute to what we see around us. And the best way to judge people, as many of these essays point out, is on an individual basis. And the classical liberal tradition is the tradition of engaging with the individual within a framework of markets. And I think this book was a great set of essays looking at how to do that from different perspectives. So I was glad to contribute. But that is the response. Either you can look at people at the group level and say, well, we notice there are differences between groups, men and women. How can we remedy that? Or you can look at people as individuals and say, well, it seems that a lot of the people of this variety want something rather different from what the people of this variety want. And there's an enormous bell curve range within both of those populations. We should treat people perhaps as individual, unique human beings. And the classical liberal tradition provides the best framework for doing the second.
Right. Thanks, Will. David?
Sure. You know, even back when I was in college in the 1980s, what I noticed is that the people on the left at school were very interested in race, almost obsessed with race. And there were some issues with that, but they did, in fact, take race as a factor in American history seriously. And in doing so, I think they were largely uncontested. You know, you'd have conservatives writing about affirmative action or modern issues, but when it came to the history of race in the United States and how that impacted both American history and the implications for the present, there's really no counter story going on. And what I noticed, meanwhile, I mean, some of the things that people on the left have pointed out historically were kind of eye-opening because you didn't get much of it in public school. So just for example, the history of the Chinese in America was basically, oh, they came in the 1840s for the gold rush, helped build the railroads, and kind of disappeared. And that was about it. And there's obviously a lot more to it. I thought it was useful for somebody, especially me, I guess, to say, you know, you've uncovered a lot of interesting history, but you don't understand economics. You don't understand the role of government in American history in exacerbating racism and racial tensions. And there's this sort of wide open field for people to take the classical liberal tradition, an understanding of economics and how markets work, and take the history that people were uncovering who are on the left, but interpret it in a way that actually makes a certain amount of sense. And that's basically a large part of what I've devoted my career to.
Great. Thank you, David. So this is Black History Month. And one question that comes up is, If we're committed to a colorblind approach to so-called race relations, can people still take pride in their heritage? I mean, does it make sense on the one hand to say we should treat others without regard to race and then have public holidays devoted to specific groups? I'll open that. You know, Zora Neale Hurston said that in the book, said that race has never achieved anything. It's always been the achievements of individuals. So do we stay the course that we're on with our heritage months, or do we do something radical like Zora Neale Hurston might propose?
Look, my position on this, as I would say, I don't like the phrase colorblindness in the sense that people aren't actually colorblind. We notice differences in each other. And I feel like people have, in a liberal society, the right, although certainly not the obligation, to have associations and celebrations based on whatever ethnic heritage. I would think of African American heritage ultimately as being more of a cultural heritage than race as such, as you know, African Americans are in fact a mixed race group, and there are vast differences between descendants of American slaves and more recent immigrants from Nigeria or Somalia. But in any event, so my objection is that the government should basically take a laissez-faire approach to it and allow people to have, you know, anything from the African American students group to Knights of Columbus or B'nai B'rith or whatever, but not neither require it nor even encourage it. And I think it's worthwhile, again, looking back to American history with a non-jaundiced view, there used to be, for example, a very substantial German-American minority who for a long time kept their traditions. There were German-American newspapers and German-American associations and the German-American League. But gradually, they assimilated into more general American life, and no one really thinks of German-Americans as being a discrete group in American society anymore, even though, again, there was once a very large network of even German-American schools and Lutheran schools. And I think that sort of approach where groups like Italian-Americans or German-Americans or Irish-Americans, which used to be considered substantial minorities with different cultures and different values, have just become Americans. I think that same approach could work with Hispanics, which is a kind of a weasel word anyway, more precisely Mexican Americans and Cuban Americans and so forth. And even for African Americans, I like to point out that in 1960, when JFK was elected president, it was still the case that people didn't know whether a Catholic person could even be elected president of the United States, whether Protestants would vote for them, even though Catholics were themselves 25% of the population. So he was starting with a nice base. As it turns out, in 1960, JFK got overwhelming support from Catholics on a product of, to a large extent, identity politics, 82%, which in turn allowed him to get elected, even though there were millions of Protestants who in fact wouldn't vote for a Catholic president, who voted for Adlai Stevenson in 56, but then voted for Nixon because they wouldn't vote for a Catholic. Now you fast forward 60 years to 2020, you have a Catholic president, Catholic Speaker of the House, Jewish Senate Majority Leader, six Catholics and two Jews on the Supreme Court. A country that had been long dominated by Protestant men is now most of the positions of significant power at the very elite Supreme Court, Majority Leader, Vice President, Minority Senate, House, Speaker of the House, all non-white men, non-Protestant white men. And if you had told people this in 1960, they would have been shocked. It would have been unbelievable to people in 1960 that you could have almost every top position in American society dominated by someone who wasn't a white Protestant man. And 2020, no one even pays attention. So I think that's the way to go with this, is to think of race in the United States as being no more immutable ultimately than ethnic differences among and religious differences among white Americans once were.
I think I have a slight disagreement with you, David, on what the government should do in terms of laissez-faire. You mentioned laissez-faire. I think that color blindness is an attitude, and I mean, what's, I think it's a better alternative than severe in-group preference. I think it's pretty well noted sociologically that some groups have significant, on average, significantly more in-group preference and prejudice in this country than other groups. And the result of our society moving in a more colorblind direction has been good, but I fear that it's coming back. I fear that we shouldn't take it for granted. Like, it's not natural. It's not necessarily natural for Americans to be more colorblind. It actually has to be advanced. And in this age of division in many cases, I think it is going to significantly decrease. What are your thoughts on that?
Will, you're at a historically Black college. I assume that they're celebrating Black History Month, and they probably celebrate the other heritage months. What do you think about this idea of, on the one hand, colorblindness, on the other, celebrating publicly racial or ethnic heritages?
Yeah, I mean, the historically Black college is located in Appalachia and it's about 40% Caucasian. So, I mean, we also do St. Patrick's Day and Hispanic Heritage Month and so on, which is, can get kind of entertaining. I mean, I don't really have a problem with any of those three. I personally, an issue that I have with the left that I've debated formally with feminists is that I don't think the personal is political. I mean, the specific context there was that I don't think you having a screaming fight with your husband necessarily means much of anything about overall crime rates or gender relations. I obviously think there should be domestic violence laws. And I think there's I think there should be battery laws. And I think that there's a good distinguishing line there. So in the formal law, and I think several of us on the panel have trained in the law, clearly there should be a basic one-page civil rights code that says you can't discriminate against the best, most meritocratic candidate because he's Asian or Black or white or whatnot. I mean, so that's fine. That obviously should exist in the law. And it's worth noting, by the way, that these campaigns on both the right and the left, let's get rid of the Civil Rights Act, freedom of association, I think are idiotic if you are a fan of meritocracy. Because there's no barrier to DEI at its wildest extreme if you get rid of the civil rights legislation. You could simply decide, I mean, 38.3% of businesses right now are minority or woman-owned. Asians, the Black middle class, so on, are doing quite well. Jewish Americans. You could simply decide to not hire anyone outside of your own race in your business if we got rid of those protections. But I mean, so yeah, keep a page or two of that on the books. That's one thing. In your private life, I don't see anything wrong with in-group identification short of the point where it becomes out-group bias, which is the social scientists know is trackable. I mean, there's a distinction there. If you like being Irish, that's fine. If you rate being Irish 8 points ahead of not being Irish, I don't really have a problem with that. I don't necessarily think the government should recognize St. Patrick's Day as a formal holiday. I wouldn't be heartbroken if they stopped formally recognizing Black History Month. But, like, should you, is it perfectly acceptable to have those celebrations? Can states have this set of days as the Black month of the year and so on? Yeah, I think there's a huge distinction between that and saying we're going to give a formal preference to Blacks or to whites in the law. So, yeah, ethnic celebrations and so on, can you apply for... Yeah, a simple example might be, can you apply for a permit for a parade called Puerto Rican Days? It's openly ethnic and involves public monies. Yes, of course you can. I don't have any problem with that at all. That's different from what discrimination law is meant to regulate. Now, well, discrimination law comes in if you say no one can come to Puerto Rican Days who's not Puerto Rican. I think that's where you start interacting with kind of the standard stayed bounds of the law. Kind of an offhand opinion. I mean, I've never written a brief or something about that topic, but that would be, that's where I would draw the line.
Right. And I think Lewis Marshall, a forgotten but very important Jewish American lawyer who's in the book in the early 20th century, he fought classification of Jews as a racial category. He succeeded to convincing the Supreme Court that state of Oregon and other states couldn't force Catholics and Lutherans and Jews into public schools dominated by Protestant boards. But at the same time, he defended the right of all these groups to pursue their own interests, you know, Catholic schools and Jewish schools and associations. So that's, I guess it's part of the freedom of association, which is also a classical liberal value. Will, you tackle a question in the second edition that many people thought was dead. It suddenly gained traction again with the UC Coates Case for Reparations article and book in 2020 after George Floyd. Democratic politicians are embracing the idea of advancing reparations for Black Americans. But you lay out three reasons why reparations are a bad idea. Can you explain that?
Well, I do one of several arguments against reparations. What I do in the book is what I call the who gets, who gives, and who's next framework. And it's pretty simple. I mean, if you look at the Black community in the United States, Black community in quotes, right now, about 40% of African Americans have at least a foreign-born grandparent. I mean, the Black community on average, about 15%. David might correct this, but at least Caucasian. So there, you're faced with this question of, are you going to genetically test people to determine the qualifications for a reparations package? Like, would I qualify as a, you know, fairly well-off businessman who's obviously, I believe I'm 40% African American, I'm 40% Celtic and 20% Plains Indian or something like that. I mean, so that you get into these really creepy questions about what exactly we're going to do, but who gives? I mean, do descendants of Union soldiers? That's kind of the classic gut punch question. But what about Hispanics? What about Asians? Like, who exactly are other groups that have faced, in many cases, nearly the same level of discrimination? Irishmen? Are they Jews? Are these people going to be paying into the tax fund used for this? And the next question would be, who's next? I mean, when we look at Native Americans make up 2 to 3% of the country, we're more abused than anyone. If we're allowing these kind of suits to be brought based on a recognized past harm, like a broken treaty or an agreement like General Sherman's original reparations deal, I would assume that players like the Cherokee Nation are going to be next up in line. I don't see why that wouldn't be the case. In fact, when I've said that online, I mean, I've been contacted by, you know, Native Americans with professional backgrounds who said, I mean, yes, that's correct. Like, the tribe has discussed that. So, I mean, there's a point where this gets a little silly. I can't imagine that the USA would then pay money to various Indian tribes and then pay money to Appalachian states and so on. So that's the core point. One thing also that I would say about reparations is this is considered wildly politically incorrect, but you face the problem of establishing a current harm. So obviously slaves were harmed by slavery. You're a fighter for the Togo Empire and you're captured by the Ashanti and you're stripped and you're put on a boat and you're sent to the Americas. Of course, that's terrible for you and your life, especially if your wife is brought along with you and so on. But for modern Black Americans, there's a very real question of, are you worse off being working middle class in the United States than you would be in Ghana? And Ghana, at least, is a stable middle income country. Let's say the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Like, and you'd really have to establish that. And you're going to be asked that in court by extremely tough people on the other side. So I don't, if this gets to the point where actual people are going against you and testing your case, I don't know if that's provable. If reparations were ever paid out, it would be in a situation where the USA was very flush with money and where there was extreme George Floyd style guilt. And right now, at least the first of those conditions doesn't exist. I don't think the second does anymore either.
Great. Thank you, Will. Kenny, in your contribution, you highlight the incredible success of Asian minorities and you try to explain the ingredients of their success. And how does this pose a counter narrative to the mantra, the DEI mantra in higher education today or in society at large?
Then convenient minority in 2019, which was 5 years ago. And since then, my views have not changed, but definitely become more nuanced. Yes. By the way, I think I reflect it in the book even back then too, which was released in 2021. But yes, Asian Americans work very hard. Yes, they are very smart. And yes, they study a lot. But we don't live in an America that necessarily values the contributions of studying as much as maybe it should. I think in an academic environment, Asians should be treated according to their study, just like everybody. Why? Because it's an academic environment. It's built for people to study. That is the whole point of a university, for you to study, not for you to be a well-rounded person, not for you to be an elite athlete. I guess elite athletics merged into the university system later. So maybe you can make a case for that. But certainly the primary purpose of a university, I think we all agree, is to study it. So that's why I think Asians should be treated according to their study habits. But in the context of university admissions, which they're obviously not. But the thing is now, America has a wide range of opportunities for all kinds of people, including people who don't study at all. America is supposed to give them jobs, give them opportunities and those kinds of things. But now university admissions officers, they now feel the need to sort of control for that in the admissions process. They feel the need to designate people's personalities based on that wide range of outcomes. And that is what I have a problem with. It's these admissions officers going way beyond their assigned mandate, so to speak. They should be treating people based on their academic merit, not based on these other criterion of success.
And one reason they can do that is, of course, they're looking at what people have filled out on checkboxes. And that's what you talk about, David, in your book and in the excerpt I included in Race and Liberty in America. Just the weird history of how we got the checkboxes that we have. Could you explain to the listeners briefly how we came up with these checkboxes, how the government came up with these checkboxes? And then I want to ask you this question. Can we go down the road Ward Connolly wanted to do and eliminate racial checkboxes entirely? Is that the solution?
So, as you mentioned, sort of my whole book is about how we got where we are, but I will try to say very briefly, except for on the census, where basically you had your black and white categories, then occasionally they'd add something else in a variety of ways, we really didn't have national checkboxes or formal rules for who was what. Also for immigration law, when we had the Asian Exclusion Act, we had to decide what Asian was. But in the 1950s, President Eisenhower issued executive orders requiring federal contractors, especially defense contractors, to abide by anti-discrimination rules. And the question was, okay, well, you asked them to, but how do you know? We didn't have a big bureaucratic civil rights bureaucracy at the time. So, well, we'll let them tell us which groups they have, if they have employees from different minority groups. Well, which minority groups? So that went through a bunch of iterations. Sometimes Jews were included, sometimes not. Sometimes Catholics were included, sometimes not. And eventually, for two major reasons, the government decided on what we call the visible minorities, the ones that we think of today. One reason was that African Americans and their civil rights organizations insisted that race was the major loci of discrimination in the U.S., and therefore we should include people who are of racial minorities. And the second rationale was that basically it was considered rude and in some states even illegal to ask people whether they were members of minority groups because it would lead to discrimination. So until the mid-1970s, the way HR people filled out civil rights forms was they looked around the room and they said, who here looks black? who here looks in those days Mexican, right? It wasn't Hispanic. That's a newfangled thing. They would look at people who looked like they were mixed race Mexican, or who looked like they were Native American, or who looked like they were Asian. And that became, and that happened to also match the historical, like, sort of nonsensical, somewhat anthropological views of the different races. So when the civil rights movement came along, those were sort of adopted without much thought, and without much thought primarily because the country until fairly recently was overwhelmingly black and white. And while there were a few edge cases, people generally, we had a one drop rule. People generally had a good idea of who they thought was black and who they thought was white. And the ambiguities that came later with, for example, Hispanics, what race are Hispanics? It could be really of any race. Well, Hispanics were generally considered until the 70s to be white, unless they specifically looked like they were clearly a member of another race. And then finally, so then back in the 70s, the government decides, we're getting increasing numbers of Hispanics and other immigrants. Again, not called Hispanics yet. How do we classify them? We don't really care how we classify them as such. We just need to have be consistent across agencies so we can compare data. In the what we now call Hispanics, I'm old enough to remember when the box was Spanish surname. Sometimes they use Spanish language household. Sometimes they only looked at Mexican Americans. Sometimes they looked at Mexican Americans and Puerto Rican Americans. Sometimes they looked at Chicanos. On and on. There are so many different criteria for who counted. They said, let's just go with one. And they kind of haphazardly decided, they set up a committee. The committee met to decide on these racial groups. There was no anthropologist involved, no geneticist, no sociologist. There's a bunch of government bureaucrats who said, let's just make something uniform for bureaucratic convenience. And it turned, and they said, this is not meant to be anthropological or scientific. It's not meant to establish eligibility for affirmative action or other government programs. But of course, once the government started having you check these boxes, they very quickly became used for every possible purpose, including for scientific research. And that's how we got where we are today.
Great, thank you. So you bring up this issue of categories, and one of the things I make a big deal about in the book is pointing out how many of the figures who embrace classical liberalism were in, they were either mixed race or they married across racial lines, which of course it gets to the creepy aspect that Will mentioned earlier. Are you one quarter this, 1/16 that? How is the government going to treat you that way? Frederick Douglass, George Schuyler, Shelby Steele, Clarence Thomas, there's probably others I'm forgetting, are all involved in racial intermarriages. Do you think that that will support classical liberal values in the future? What do you think, Will? You call them swirl Americans, people that get together and have children are swirl Americans.
I use that line in the book. I think so. I mean, well, first of all, in terms of classical liberal values, where the idea is that, as long as it's not dishonorable, you pursue what's best for the individual, in a competitive, free-willed setting. Yeah, there's nothing really more suited to that than falling in love with whoever you find interesting, rejecting these ancient tribal hatreds. I mean, you're a Greek and she's a Turk, who cares? I think that from almost a genetic perspective, certainly a quant political science perspective, the growing rate of interracial marriage is probably the best thing possible for the USA. I mean, a couple of the panelists have mentioned that there's this whole process. I mean, there's a book written from the left, but quite good, How the Irish Became White. So, I mean, technically speaking, in terms of the strictest law, most European groups always were mostly considered white. But socially, I mean, they're very definitely, in terms of country clubs and fraternal organizations and so on, there were law. I mean, there were stringent rules discriminating against Jews, discriminating against people of Celtic descent, so on down the line, for much of the country's history. I mean, it was noted that even the Germans were considered sort of a an interesting outcast minority that dressed differently and all this for 100 years. And what changed that to a certain extent was assimilation at the level of people marrying into long settled families and learning the native tongue, accepting local attitudes toward food and women's rights and so on. And I think there's kind of a weird idea that that won't happen along continental racial lines. that Asians or Blacks or something like that are going to be more distinct than Sicilian peasants or Muslim North Africans or shoeless Irish immigrants or something like that. I'm not denigrating any of those groups, but I don't think that's true in really sort of standard deviation terms. I think if you just go to a working class community, you'll see very often sort of a brunette Appalachian girl and African-American boyfriend or husband, and I'll have two kids, and the kids will be sort of Moroccan looking in skin color and very patriotic Americans. And I think that after you see the same thing with Asian and white couples on the West Coast. And I don't think that after a couple generations of that, the biases we have now will make a lot of sense to a lot of people. This is a last sentence, but this is one of the things with the quote unquote replacement or population replacement argument on the right that doesn't make a lot of sense, really. The argument, I guess, is that the white population of the United States is declining or being forced out in favor of other populations. But if you look at genetics, 23andMe population baselines instead of how people identify themselves, the United States is 76% white. Many of the whites happen to be Hispanic. Another 8% or so is Asian American. That's the highest performing group in the country. Another 5% is interracial. The same 12% is Black. I believe Jews, me and I, are now broken out as a population group, 2%. So you really don't have some kind of mysterious, undefined invasion of people that we're not familiar with. We're just somewhat changing the definitions we're using for ourselves.
Great. We're running out of time. I know we're going to have a question and answer period. I want to ask one last question. What one thing could the Trump administration do to improve race relations in this country?
It's being done in not the most subtle way, but I think discouraging the DEI industry and racial preferences is probably, you know, basically undoing a lot of the emphasis the government itself is putting on race. Again, I don't think there's a problem as such with people having, as Will said, their in-group identity, as long as it doesn't become out-group bias. But also, as Will was just talking about, we really have had a dramatic increase in interracial marriages, interracial mixing, inter-ethnic mixing, and that has the potential to lead to us just establishing a common American identity that's not racially based, just like we now think of all these different groups that used to be separated out ethnically as just all being white Americans. There's no reason we all just can't become American Americans. And the problem we have is that there are vested interests in government, in interest groups and corporations in the our educational system that's very happy with the current system of dividing everyone into boxes. And they want to perpetuate that. At the grassroots level, you see what Will was talking about, couples of every possible description mixing together. And I'd say elite universities, you have them try to do the opposite, having separate graduation ceremonies and separate orientations and special grievance studies classes and so forth. So I think getting the government out of the racial grievance business is a very strong and powerful step toward letting the grassroots do its work.
Right. Kenny?
I agree with David. Just eliminate DEI.
Mary, do we have questions from the audience?
Thank you so much, everybody. We're going to open it for questions now. Members of the media who are on as panelists can just raise their hand and our technician will unmute you. Those in the general audience, please type your questions into the chat and we'll ask them of the panelists. And we do have a couple we can start with. First of all, with one of the suggestions for moving completely to merit-based decision-making is using standardized tests. However, some people don't do well on tests. Are there other ways we can use to ensure the candidates have multiple ways to demonstrate their merit?
I can answer that. I'm a big proponent of tests. Tests capture merit that is otherwise not found. For example, a lot of boys do not do well in school. They get C's. I interviewed a white guy named Michael Munger who is now the Duke university professor of economics, by the way, but he grew up in an orange farm in Florida, and he basically failed out of all of his classes from eighth to ninth grade until somebody caught his test score. And they said, this is ridiculous for somebody who's getting C's and D's in these classes. And the reality was he just wasn't a good, he wasn't a good student, but he was very bright. He was lazy, but they caught him, and they were able to develop him because of basically his sheer intellectual potential. So yeah, you need tests to measure sheer intellectual potential. And that can better and more accurately place somebody into their preferred program.
Right. Thank you.
One of the ironies of the last 50 plus years is that employers used to give the equivalent, some sort of employment suitability test, which often was about IQ, but also other factors that would make you a successful employee, but they had a so-called disparate impact on racial minorities, or at least on especially Black Americans, and the Supreme Court banned them. The irony is that because employers could no longer rely on these tests, they instead substituted getting a college degree as sort of the minimum criteria for a lot of jobs. And that had an even greater disparate impact. But you know, your average upper middle class judge went to college and a good law school thinks, oh, college, of course you need that. Whereas a just an employment test, well, you don't need that sort of thing. So you wound up with a situation where especially people who are coming from the lower part of the socioeconomic spectrum, who may have been able, may not have had the educational credentials, but could have aced a written test, wind up, you know, not being eligible for a lot of jobs because they don't have the social capital to make it through high school, 4 years of college, or maybe also a graduate degree.
Right.
That last point quickly, I think, had a really massive impact on society that we often neglect. I mean, that's Grigsby Duke Power. I mean, right now in the United States, it's generally illegal, at least civilly, to use like basic IQ, EQ, SAT model, whatever tests as a qualifier for a job, because they're considered to have a disparate impact across racial and to some extent sexual lives. So you can't just give a 5-page test to applicants and see who the smartest guys are and then hire them. And as a result of that, the college has become almost mandatory for every middle and upper middle class job. And we kind of take that as a given, but that wasn't the case to anything like today's extent for most of history. Like, I read the other day that I think it's 70% of white and Black males currently go to college for at least some period of time. So we're really top loading the educational system. There's no reason for 70% of people to go to university or even a technical college. There are not that many upper middle class jobs. It's something like a third of that. So this disaffected lower elite problem is one reason we've got so much anger among, in particular, young men.
Thank you. As John pointed out, the first edition of Race and Liberty came out during the Obama administration, when, of course, there was great optimism that we're moving to a race-blind or post-racial America. The events since then have been very dramatic, and this new edition comes out at a great time. We now have a president who sometimes can speak in ways that are very divisive. Is there any advice to him to how he could be more of a uniter around race that you could offer?
I think that Trump is a person who was elected from a lot of different resentments that were going on. And the first thing that to be a uniter around race is that you have to acknowledge the resentments, the various resentments that a lot of different Americans have. There are resentments from Black Americans to white Americans. He has to figure out a message on that. How does he tackle? He is a white American. So he has to speak to Black Americans in a way that says, hey, I understand that you resent us to some extent. What am I going to do about that? There are resentments from Palestinian Americans to Jewish Americans. He has to speak to that too, especially to those that voted for him because of that. And then he has to, for me, I mean, obviously Asian Americans, very important. There's a lot of resentments from Asian Americans right now to the system, basically, that basically said, hey, we're going to accept you immigrant-wise. You come here, you work hard, you succeed. And then the reality is just very, very different. So Trump has to speak to that from our case. So the best way for him to be uniter is for him to acknowledge all of these various resentments and figure out a way to speak to each of them individually.
Thank you. Another question from the audience. Would abolishing the Department of Education help demolish the DEI programming that's currently enshrined in public education up through the universities? Would returning control and leadership to the local entities help restore classical liberal values and benefit the individual students in a natural, if not messy, way?
I think that would be a good first step. It certainly would eliminate the contribution of the Department of Education to DEI. But I think that the problem is deeper than that. It's a cultural problem in higher education. This is a sector of our society that's going to resist. It's going to be like the massive resistance of Southern segregationists in the 1950s. And I think there's already signs, at least in blue states, that they're doubling down. So they're going to try to find other sources of authority to do this. I agree with the reader that that's probably a good step to get rid of the Department of Education, not just because of DEI. But higher education is very ideologically imbalanced and will continue to be a problem in race relations in the future.
I think there's actually also an increasing problem in K-12 education, encapsulated most dramatically in California's battles over ethnic studies. There's nothing wrong, of course, with incorporating salient things about ethnic history into America. It is part of American history. America is composed of a lot of different ethnic groups, so you can't have American history with no ethnic history. But really, radical left activists with teachers unions and inside the educational establishment is really trying to impose a extremely left-leaning, identity politics-oriented, anti-American, to a large extent, against traditional American values curriculum into the schools. The curriculum, some of the curricula that have been proposed are infused with racism, anti-Semitism, and other bad isms. And getting rid of the U.S. Department of Education will resolve some issues, but it will not resolve what goes on in the Berkeley, California school district or the Los Angeles County School District and so forth.
Okay, no, Wilfred had to jump off. He was teaching a class and had to get to it. So we have one final question. We have several other questions, but we have time for one more. With proliferation of solo digital experiences and divisions, how can we bring the younger population into a more centrist and balanced point of view on race?
I think the younger population is probably a more centrist and balanced point of view than you'd think, largely because of mixed race, interracial, and some of this acknowledgement that's going on in media about the various issues that are going on. I think the biggest thing that younger people have to work on is resisting indoctrination in the university system and really K-12 system. I mean, exactly what David said, California just passed mandatory ethnic studies. Ethnic studies, basically, if you read the curriculum, it's divided into four categories: Asians, Blacks, Black Americans, Latino, and Native American. Already, they're propagating these four categories upon these eighth graders, you know, and that's gonna be really impactful to their worldview. If immediately in eighth grade or seventh grade you start learning about race through these four categories as if that's the current and the only way to understand race, and of course the various oppression stories that go into that, and then don't even forget what David said about Jewish Americans and how they're not really considered in any of these categories anyways. So that, all of that, I think the main thing that we have to do with young people is we have to teach them how to resist the education system's logic on this.
The good news on the California Ethnic Studies requirement is that they didn't impose a set curriculum, and schools can choose their own. So Independent Institute has developed an alternative ethnic studies curriculum, and we're marketing it to schools. It's available on our website if people want to look at it. It's very balanced, and I think addresses some of those concerns you raised rightly, Kenny. I want to thank you all today for being here, and everyone in our audience for participating. We're delighted to have been able to produce this updated edition of Race and Liberty in America and commend it to everyone. Thank you so much, John, for editing and contributing to it, and to Kenny, David, and Wilfred for participating in today's conversation.